Okay, so let's go for it.
Okay.
Hey, Rafia, great to see you again.
Nice to see you. Thanks for having me on your amazing podcast amongst many other amazing people. Great company. Thank you.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. I was just remembering, I think we first met almost 20 years ago in Frankfurt at the EVPA gathering there. Was that around 2007, 2008, something like that?
It must have been 2008. I remember that was my first EVPA. I had just joined JP Morgan. It was a long time ago, hey?
I know. It's incredible. It's scary how fast the time goes. But so you had started out prior to that in venture capital and then moved into, obviously, it sounded very exciting working for JP Morgan, where you were managing large amounts of, you know, social investment, and obviously their foundation is incredible what they're doing. But what made you make that shift from sort of more typical finance, if you like, into that?
I kind of always had a calling for this space, like the social impact space. So by academia, you know, I'm a development economist. I did my bachelor's in business, though, and I always wanted to look at international development from a business angle. But, you know, at that time, there was no venture philanthropy. I mean, it was just starting, right? There was no impact investing. So when I graduated from the LSE with my master's in 2004, you either go into the private sector or you go work for a nonprofit. And I chose the private sector, again, because I wanted to, you know, kind of be at the center of it. And so I was in venture capital for a couple of years, worked in venture capital research, was at a VC firm for one whole year, which felt like eternity because, you know, you're doing the 18 hours a day. And it was amazing. You know, it was a steep learning curve, learned a lot, but I knew it wasn't my calling. And so I actually just left and started working at Deloitte Emerging Markets, which is management consultancy, as you know, Deloitte, but it was a public sector arm. So it brought me closer to clients like, I have to say, rest in peace, USAID and UK Aid and, you know, the bilaterals and multilaterals. And so, you know, I was really happy at least getting closer to that world. And then I moved into corporate philanthropy. So that's when we met. I think I just joined like a few months ago. It was the year of the crash. So the financial crash. And
yeah,
I joined in the summer. And I was like, well, this is going to be a short job. But, you know, luckily I'd chosen the right bank that weathered the storm better than the others. And in fact, JP Morgan increased its giving, which was amazing. And so I was there for about 7 years, grew to manage their social investments in Africa and the Middle East, and then moved into the private philanthropy world. So with the Sainsbury Family Foundation, with the Sainsbury Family Foundation.
Gatsby,
and then
they call it,
Gatsby, exactly. And then I was running Womanity Foundation, which I think you know of as well, family foundation based in Geneva, which threw me into the world of gender equity, which was amazing. And then I stepped down from that role because after 17 years of living in London, we moved to Munich, and it's been 5 years that I'm now in Munich and joined LeBec about 3 years ago. So it's been definitely an interesting journey.
Yeah, and you've kind of stayed. Once you made that switch over, you've stayed in that kind of impact space, which is great. Do you think, I often wonder about this, where it was a very exciting time around 2007-8. I'd also just done my MBA and did my research on venture philanthropy, and I was so excited to see those two worlds coming together because, as you say, prior to that, they were so separate. And I feel like your choice to go into the private sector to start rather than, say, the charity sector, that's interesting. I feel like that's probably a good move because it's almost like learning it in what would be considered finance in the mainstream kind of sets you up then to sort of know how to use it for impact. Would you agree? Or
absolutely. I think I'm really lucky that it went that way. It taught me a lot about different motivations of different people. And, you know, this world is all about relationships and relationship building. And so understanding how the finance sector works. And then now, Ravnil, we have all the in-between. Before, we didn't have that, right? It was this and that. And so I think understanding that world, and I always wanted to understand that so I could bring some of the efficiencies of this world. I mean, we can debate that. But, you know, some of the lessons from this world over to the impact sector. And so, I was really lucky to kind of go that way. And having said that, I think it's interesting because in the impact investment space, I feel there's still a lot of that lived experience that international development people have is still missing, right? And so I think the learning needs to go both ways.
Yeah, I would agree entirely. That was one of the things that came out in my own research on it, is that when we're successful in business, we can sometimes think we know the best way for everything.
Right.
Where there are, of course, major skills and, you know, pros that come with private capital. But then obviously, as you say, learning the other way is equally important too. So I ask every guest about what's their sort of the SDG that means something to them the most. I'd love to hear yours. What's the one that kind of feels close to your heart?
It's a great question. It's very hard to choose one. But I think for me, it would be SDG 5. You know, the gender equality is very hard to choose one also, because I don't think we can work on them in silos, as they're all interconnected, right? And it's more from a personal perspective, not because I think that's the one most important that we need to address. It's more just, I think my personal journey into gender equality, you know, didn't start in a classroom or a boardroom or, you know, in a nonprofit or anywhere else. It started really at home. You know, I grew up in Pakistan. I'm one of five daughters. And in a context where being a girl often, you know, came with limits before you even understood what those limits might mean in the future. But I was lucky, you know, my sisters and I had parents who really defied those limits every single day. And, you know, my father, he really believed the most radical thing he could give his daughters wasn't protection, but it was education. He used to say, if you're educated, you'll never have to depend on anyone to define your path. And I have to say that conviction really became my North Star. But I also have to say, you know, speaking of gender and women, my mother was the quiet revolution behind it all. You know, she kind of made that belief real. She stood by us, encouraged every ambition, and held the line whenever the world tried to almost shrink it. And so her strength was, you know, that role model that was steady, unwavering, and most of the time, unfortunately, invisible. But it's the very reason, you know, we could get through it all. So I think why it's closest to my heart, I've kind of always known that my story, our story, my sister's, was the exception and not the norm. And that realization comes with a bit of responsibility. You know, it's what drives me to keep pushing for systems where equity isn't about having lucky or extraordinary parents, but it's about fairness and structure. And now that also I'm a parent myself, I think, and to a daughter and a son, that mission feels even more personal. You know, every time I look at my kids, I'm reminded that the world we are building, or in these days failing to build, is the one they're going to inherit. And so how do we want to leave that, right? And that thought alone, on those difficult days, no matter how heavy the headlines feel, which they feel very heavy right now, kind of keeps me going. And
yeah,
so for me, it would be that one.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks for sharing such a personal story as well. Did you come to the UK at a certain age from Pakistan, or?
Yeah, so my father was actually, so this, and I think this world, the social impact space or international development work, I'm inclined to also because my father was in it. So he was the head of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN in Uganda, in China for a very long time, in 7 years. So, and before that, he was working for the Pakistani government, but with the Ministry of Agriculture. I left Pakistan when I was 8, moved to Turkey for 4 years, and I grew up in China, where I met Ali Lebak, who I'll tell you, and Lebak, I'll tell you more about where I'm working now. So we actually went to high school together.
Full circle.
And we joke about the fact that, oh my God, you know, in 10th grade, did we think that we were going to be doing this? But yeah, so I was in China for 7 years. So my formative years were in Beijing. And then I moved to the U.S. for my undergraduate degree. So I actually only moved to London for my master's in 2003.
All of that explains your multilingual abilities. I was just reading about it and I was going, my God, it's like 5 or 6 languages. It's incredible. But that explains it a little bit better.
exactly. And I'm not fluent in all of them. You know, aging has a part to do with it.
Yeah. It's funny you also mentioned about the gender equality in education, because I think we connected again through the Womanity Foundation when I was doing my documentary, A Girl Can Touch the Sky, that was also all about gender equality and education in India. But obviously the similar patterns happen in many parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just amazing how transformational education can be, hugely transformational, you know, generationally.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, amazing. So the work that you're doing now, I was just having a look at the Lebek website, and I like the sort of the style, the creative style of the webpage, where it's all kind of almost like cut out art and it moves through. It's quite a nice narrative. But I loved it was talking about mainstreaming innovative finance. And I think that's an interesting angle, because a lot of times like, for example, whether it's the B Corp movement or whether it's social enterprise or whether it's impact investment, whatever it is, you know, we that are in that world think it's everywhere and everyone's talking about it. But in reality, it's very often a very fringe kind of thing or not mainstream. And so how we can sort of influence in the mainstream to take on some of these things is obviously massively important. So I wanted to ask you, like, what role do you think storytelling plays, or why is that important in philanthropy and innovative finance to help us get to where we want to get to?
Yeah, I love that. When we talked about being on the podcast, it kind of really pushed me to think about how that is so important. So I'm really glad we're having this conversation, because having pondered upon it, I think it's, you know, I've spent my career at the intersection of philanthropy, impact investing, and a bit of development finance as well. And you know, having been pushed to think about this, one thing I think that is so important is that I realize money alone is not shifting systems, right? Stories do. And storytelling is such an important part of it. That's why I'm so glad actually you have a podcast dedicated to it. We often talk about capital as if it were purely technical. You know, terms like blended finance and catalytic capital or risk return ratios, that they get thrown around, like you said. But behind
it, sounds
all
very transactional, doesn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. And behind all of this and all these structures or, you know, whatever we're talking about is a story, right? About who we believe can create change, what we think is risky and what is not, and what outcomes count, right? And so those stories quietly shape where billions of dollars are flowing or they're not flowing. And so in the world of today, I think where we have so many competing challenges, I feel philanthropy and finance have become overly technical. We talk about KPIs and IRRs and theories of change, but we're losing that human story behind what those numbers mean, right? And so I think storytelling is hugely important, because it reconnects purpose with people, and it's a way to bridge logic with emotion. And those two, in my opinion, are the biggest ingredients of making major transformational change.
Yeah, agreed. And one of the powerful things about storytelling, and particularly like film or video, is that actually its strength is the emotion.
Right.
So I think sometimes we fall into the trap of the poor cousin sort of theory or the poor cousin syndrome. And sometimes when we are the, let's say, the smaller player, like say we're the impact investors or the social investors, and there's the big boy investors or whatever, you know, the mainstream.
Yeah.
That we kind of feel that we need to double down on being even more efficient and even more effective and even more kind of perfect with our models, et cetera, to kind of justify what we're doing. Whereas they often don't appear to always need to. They can take bigger risks. They can do what they want, you know, because they're sort of in pursuit of just profit. And I get it. There's a kind of a bigger responsibility that comes with maybe also trying to impact communities and stuff. It's not just about the money. But I do fear that sometimes it cripples us in our ambition or our risk taking and the stories that we're willing to tell, because we want to play it safe because we don't want to fail.
Yeah.
Because it, does that make sense?
I think risk is a big, big aspect of it, but I think stories can shift that risk, right? Traditional philanthropy has been focused on the giver, right? Like impact reports and donor narratives usually feel like we've celebrated, oh, the donor, and not really the local ingenuity. Whereas I feel real change kind of happens bottom up. And so the communities that are solving those problems daily, often long before capital arrives, because they need to be able to live, right? And so
they're already working on it in some way or another. Exactly.
And so I think storytelling is actually very important here, because it rebalances that power by changing the lens, right? And so, and not just the language. So when locals tell their own stories, funders see innovation, right? Like they're innovating, and it's not like the help me syndrome or the, or, you know, like a showing that there's some sort of deficiency here. I think it moves us from that aid mentality to agency, you know, going from thinking that I'm here to help you or we help them to actually we're investing in these solutions that they've already built. And I think that's really important, especially in the backdrop of today where aid has retracted massively. We need to talk about investments, right? And we need to talk about that change in storytelling, that changing the lens and not just the language. So reframing.
Yeah, that's a very good point. One of the things that I've talked about for a long time is also, and it ties into that, is not making what we do or the organization that we're part of the hero of the story. Because I think in typical marketing and stuff, that's what's been done for such a long time. Like, you know, and not just in philanthropy, in general in marketing. And I think where there's a real kind of trick is to as you say, make customers or the beneficiaries or the partners or the staff celebrate them. And actually all of that goodwill comes back on the organization anyway.
Exactly.
You know, so it fulfills your needs, but it's as you say, bottom up. It's a much more wholesome and kind of equitable kind of way of doing it, isn't it?
Exactly. And I think if we take a moment to talk about the gender space and climate, for instance, right? When we talk about women in the social impact space, we portray them a lot of the times as like passive recipients of philanthropy or aid, right? Whereas they're active members of society, often leading the solutions that are being developed to challenges that the communities are facing every day. And like I mentioned climate change, and I'll quote one statistic by Project Drawdown, which ranks supporting and investing in women and girls in developing and emerging markets. You know that one, you know, as the second
I'm already smiling.
Yeah, exactly. It's the second most important of 76 critical solutions for curbing global warming to 2 degrees. So think about that. I mean, that's a big data point. And it makes you think, well, how is that so? Well, it is because women are on the front lines of climate change. And because of that, they're very knowledgeable about its risks for their families and for their communities and society. And they also have unique insights around solutions, right? And that are channeled into local businesses from both being a consumer and also like looking at it entrepreneurially, because they have to come up with these solutions. And lastly, women are at the center of societal relationships and networks, right? They're kind of at the center of that weaving net of society, and they can leverage these relationships for those that are on the fringes of society. I mean, we know many entrepreneurs doing that well, right? Ajita Shah and others. Yeah. Whilst they're most affected with climate change, they also are, you know, provided the right investments and the right opportunities, they can be the solution. And when they're not portrayed as victims, but as leaders in innovation, the conversation and the capital flow can change.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And it's like you say, they're often the glue that keeps everything moving, you know, in reality. And of course, we all would have heard of like that sort of maybe came to the broader consciousness when Muhammad Yunus was investing in women entrepreneurs in Bangladesh, and they would always, you know, be totally reliable, paying back, you know, whereas the same microloans to men, you know, was not always as successful at all in actually paying it back and being responsible with what they could do with it. Because given that opportunity, they would make the most of it for their family, their community, et cetera, right?
Exactly. And even if you take it in mainstream business, I mean, we know that women-led businesses generate a higher return on investment. Yet, you know, I hope it's not the same still, but it's, what is it, 2% of venture capital funds go to women-led businesses. So
yeah.
I think it's a narrative shift that's required across. It's not just in the development impact space. It's required in all our spaces.
And I loved as well when I was looking at Lebec, it's a women-led and mostly women, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Which is awesome.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, yeah. That was my, you know, one of the draws to it as well. We are women-led and women-owned, which is amazing. And we exist in mainstream innovative finance, and to really look at how we can shift the needle on some of the issues that we're talking about. And narrative change is a big part of that.
Yeah, for sure. And I was just thinking earlier as well, like just to finish that point, like with storytelling through visual means, emotion is obviously the major part of it, but actually the perfect recipe, if you like, is sort of maybe 60-70% story and emotion, and then maybe 20-30% data and insights, because I think that you do need both. But I do feel like it's almost like, I often use this analogy, that the job of a powerful piece of content or a brand film is to get you to do two things: to go, I get it, so you understand clearly, and then to go, I like it and I want to know more. So it's giving you a reason to care.
Exactly.
You know, and so the data and the information, some people are really into it just naturally, but not all of us. But if you can make people care, then they can dive a bit more into the data. But if you start with data, a lot of people, you just lose them.
You lose them. That's exactly right. We actually, I mean, work with entrepreneurs at Lebec, and we work with their value propositions because they're living and breathing this every day, right? It's hard for them to take that step back. A lot of the times, you know, they start with that data point, right? And we actually help them look at clearly indicating their why first, right? And so why are you doing what you're doing? And that is that hook that you're talking about that then sparks that curiosity, right? What is that problem they're trying to solve? And then secondly, the how. A lot of the organizations will start with that how, right? And then go to the why. But to your point, you lose them, right? Because in the world of today, where so many people are knocking on that same door. I think getting that story right and getting that hook and creating that curiosity is what's going to get you ahead of the line.
For sure. And I think we have a very similar approach. I think the same principle applies to every organization. When you're in it, you're often too close to it to be able to see it with that perspective. I love a phrase I often say to prospective clients. I think it's Oscar Wilde. He said, "I would have written you a shorter letter, but I didn't have time." And it's that idea that actually to consolidate and make something simple and concise and is actually really hard.
Yeah. Similarly, I read a quote the other day. I think it was a global leader. Maybe you came across it as well. But he said, "If I have to speak for 1 hour, I can prep in 15 minutes. But if I have to speak for 15 minutes, it's going to take me days to write that one."
Exactly. Same idea. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
What narratives do you think in global finance might need to be rewritten? Because obviously, whenever we're trying to do these different things that we're trying to do, we're doing it kind of on a playing board, if you like, or, you know, we talk about system change and stuff. But so obviously, we're trying our best within frameworks. So if there are narratives that you think it would be helpful if they could be rewritten in global finance, what do you think they might be?
So I think the biggest one for me is probably going to be the whole silos mentality. You'll hear me talk about this a lot. And it's one of our big areas of focus through our convenings that we do at Lebec. The silos of capital narrative, I think, needs to be rewritten. We've grown to internalize the idea that philanthropic, public, and private capital needs to act separately. And I think it's one of the most limiting narratives in our sector, you know, that each form of capital has its own lane or its own box, and philanthropy needs to stay concessional, and development finance should focus on de-risking, and commercial investors only come in when the risk is gone. And that mindset fragments the ecosystems and keeps us unlocking capital at scale. And so I think we need to move from a capital stack mentality, which is very linear and hierarchical, to a capital system. We have this capital system available. It's interconnected, it's iterative, and it's collaborative, right? And so the story we need to tell is of a capital continuum, which is what we talk about a lot at Lebec, and not segregation. It's a story where grants can de-risk innovation and blended finance can accelerate proof of concept and private capital can scale what's working. And this is all guided by a collective narrative of shared impact, right? We know that philanthropy, impact investing, commercial capital alone isn't going to solve these big challenges. And so how do we make that all work together? And secondly, if I may, I also think, you know, drawing on my experience of deploying philanthropic capital, and another narrative that needs to be reframed is around the nature of philanthropic capital itself. I firmly believe that philanthropy has to work smarter. It has to work more catalytically. It's the only capital in the world that can take risk. Yet in so many times, it's so risk averse. It has the power to be catalytic. And that means not just filling funding gaps, but unlocking new solutions and attracting other forms of capital into critical sectors. And so I think we need to move it away from risk aversion to funding that's bold and flexible. So I think if we can rewrite those two narratives, we'll be in a much better place to address these complex challenges we're facing.
Yeah, no, those are brilliant insights. It's funny, it reminds me of the current episode that's out with Audrey Sellian. She made a similar comment about it seems so uncomfortable, I guess, that in a way many people are trying to solve the same challenges, yet they aren't speaking to each other. And it's slightly different, but it's a similar point, you know. And if everyone was to kind of join forces around whether it's an SDG or whether it's a particular goal in a particular country or whatever it might be, or unlocking a new market, how more effective it would be. What I'd love to hear a bit more about, though, is let's say there are examples, because I'm sure, you know, you're already doing it to some extent, where different types of finance are being brought together. I was reading on the site as well, where it talked about different types of capital being useful for different gaps or different parts of the journey, which kind of, I guess, they already, as you said, in silos might realize, but they're not joined up in how they bring themselves together. And just lastly, before I hand over on that to hear your thoughts, I remember way back when I was, not long after we met probably first, I met John Kingston, who was running Venturesome, and I remember he said to me, he said, "We're a small fund," he said, "but I see our role as," it's quite poetic actually, he said, "our job is to sail as close to the rocks as we can to find out where the rocks are." So to take really big risks just to kind of figure out where we can go, what's possible. And so, and I think it was CAF Venturesome, Charities Aid Foundation. So maybe it was philanthropic money. There's incredible power there for someone to take that huge risk at the beginning, which could potentially unlock a huge pathway for everyone else. But if you don't take that risk and find out, you might never find out, you know.
No, that's exactly right. I think risk-taking is a huge part of philanthropy that we've somehow lost along the way. I've been in board meetings where, you know, been told, well, what's the most risk-free investment we can make? And it's like, really? I mean, you know, there is an inherent risk in philanthropy. And if we're not comfortable with that, you're in the wrong space, right? Yeah. And that is the magic of philanthropy as well, because it can provide that first-loss capital in a blended finance structure to attract commercial investors. You can use guarantees and concessional loans to strengthen investee balance sheets, and you can support impact funds and social enterprises that have high potential but lack access to traditional financing. And so philanthropy can act as that bridge, providing that patient capital, which, you know, likes of Acumen and some organizations are doing so beautifully, that needed to develop that proof of concept model that can later attract commercial investors. And there's nothing wrong with that. We've built industries on this, right? It's just that we don't question it when it's in the mainstream commercial sector. We are much harder on the philanthropy sector, right? It's, you know, that donor syndrome of when we put philanthropic dollars in an organization, we're so keen to tell them how to manage that, right? But if you're investing in a public company, you're not going to tell them how to run that company, right? And so why does that mentality, that's why going back to that first point, there is lessons to be learned from both sides of the spectrum, right? And there's a lot in between that we don't know.
Yeah, that's actually kind of what I was alluding to when I was talking about that kind of poor cousin syndrome earlier.
Yeah.
Like say if you're, my wife is, you know, also British Indian. And she would tell me, I remember we were walking through the school playground one time during COVID. It was busy, busy, lots of people walking every direction. She said to me afterwards, she said, you do realize when you walk, like people move out of the way. She said, that doesn't happen for me, you know? And I was like, I had no idea, you know? And so I guess, you know, whether it's sometimes you hear stories, you know, whether someone's from, say, an ethnic minority or, you know, a woman or... And you often hear that, oh, we feel we have to work so much harder to kind of get the same kind of outcomes. And I guess it's maybe that's the kind of thing I'm alluding to there, like with the philanthropy space or the impact investment space. My gut feeling is that's why they're so risk averse, because they don't want to sort of trip up or be criticized. Like they need to be legitimized. And I feel it's unfortunate because they have their own strengths and they should be allowed to. I don't know. It just feels like they're in the shadow of maybe. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I mean, back in the day, philanthropy arms of banks, big corporates were the poor cousin. You were not a revenue generating arm of the institution, right? And so it's similar, right? It's that kind of what you're talking about. You have to constantly prove your worth. It is a very unfortunate part of the sector. I think it's changing a lot.
That's good.
You know, we're 20 years in. God, it makes you realize how old you are. But, you know, like, I think it is changing for the better, but it's slow. And on the other side, I think on the investor side, the risk comes, I believe, from the lack of knowledge and understanding, right? Because what you don't know can be scary. But once you do know, and that's why storytelling is so important and shifting that narrative and giving that agency to the people creating change is so important, because I think that breaks down that barrier. So, whereas investors might see something from a risk angle, that goes away once you start, you know, shifting that lens. So I think that risk thing is very much coming from a lack of understanding, lack of knowledge, because what you don't know can be scary. And in fact, actually, just talking about, you know, blended capital and the risk bit, Alix, actually, our CEO and founder recently, I don't know if you read it, Ravnil wrote a piece that was featured in Katie Couric Media where she talks about the global water crisis and she spent 10 years building Water Equity, right? Which is a global asset manager dedicated to mobilizing private investment for the water and sanitation sector. And it's an amazing story. I mean, I love it because it spun out of a nonprofit, right? And so really kind of going the other way. And water.org has now transformed, you know, every dollar in philanthropic support into $17 in investment to provide that safe water and sanitation to millions of people in emerging markets. And what I like about this story is that it demonstrates that Water access is not a charity play, right? It's a viable investment that delivers both impact and returns. And that reframing has shown institutional investors that, you know, water is investable. It's a sector that was once seen as uninvestable is now investable. And so I think that's kind of the narrative change, the importance of stories. And also at Lebec, we do these convenings where we bring different players across the capital spectrum together, from philanthropists to impact investors to institutional investors, commercial investors, with entrepreneurs on a purpose to when you show how blended finance structure and how some of these things work in practice, it takes that risk away, right? We were talking about how not knowing is a bit of a risky thing. But once you see it working, rather than just talking about it, I mean, we can talk about it till the cows come home, but until you see it working, it doesn't give you that comfort. And so I think it's really important to show and tell.
No, but you're absolutely right. It's like show and tell in school, isn't it, where your kids bring in something to show it.
Yes.
But actually, I know we're laughing about that, but actually it's very true. Like when a child gets to bring in something from home that's personal and meaningful to them, that's where their personality comes out. They're not just one of 30
that's
in the class now. That's where people get to know what you like, what you're interested in, what your sort of quirks are. And it's great. It's brilliant. So it's very much the same. I think the word that was ringing out in my ears when you were just talking about that was, it helps build trust, because when you see someone like a real person in a real community with a real family and a story, like a human story, you kind of go, yeah, okay, that person may be living in a different part of the world from me. They may have different challenges, but in many ways, we share a lot of the similar things that are human, you know, ups and downs and all the rest of it. And you start to relate on a human level. It becomes real, if you like, rather than. And I think, as you say, that's where you can really connect with the heart of it. You know, of course, you still have to be, you know, efficient and do your due diligence and all that good stuff that you need to do. But you understand that there is something meaningful there beyond, like, that capital and money is a very powerful force.
Right.
But it can do really amazing things as well, like not just, you know, accumulate for, you know, for private, you know, but you know what I mean?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's that show and tell aspects. You start to see opportunity and not just risk, right? Because again, that unknown is risky. But once you can see and feel, to your point, it starts to shift and it starts to shift, hopefully, capital. And we've seen that work really well.
Yeah, and actually, it's one of the things I was going to ask you as well. How do you think narratives can change, like unlock more capital, like, or how it kind of flows? Because obviously, we're always coming to something in how it is today. How do you think we could look at narrative or storytelling as a way to change how it flows?
Yeah, it's a really, really good question. I mean, I think, to your point, I think something you said in the beginning, capital doesn't move on data alone, right? It moves on conviction, right? And a story builds that conviction. So when we tell stories that reframe risk and open up opportunity, we expand investors' comfort zones. And so a story about a social entrepreneur navigating complexity humanizes that risk and it makes innovation almost investable, right? I think storytelling has a way of realigning incentives when philanthropy is portrayed not as something that's just nice that fills a gap, but as risk capital, right? It legitimizes experimentation and it attracts follow-on investment. And, you know, like I said, at Lebec, our narrative change work makes blended finance visible. You know, after convenings where funders hear directly from entrepreneurs, they often redefine how their own capital fits into that ecosystem. I think storytelling is usually important. It doesn't just warm hearts. It moves money if done right.
Yeah, and actually, like, capital and money can actually have a huge impact. I think that's the thing that I think is the most exciting. Like, as you said, you're sitting in a meeting and people are saying, what's the most risk-free thing that we can do? I don't know about you, but like when I wake up in the morning, and I think a lot of people are like this, especially people, private money, I think as well, especially, they want to do something exciting, impactful, be part of something really dynamic, right? Not just go, oh, how can I sort of just really vanilla kind of safely use my money? They want to go like, okay, I know there's risks, but I'm up for the challenge. I want to try and do something amazing, right? And that's the kind of energy I think that storytelling can really unlock and magnify as well. And I was just thinking of a guy, Richard Turner, who's I've also interviewed for the podcast. He's the CEO of SolarAid. And they did something similar where the philanthropy, they're a small charity, actually really small.
Yeah.
But they established a market in East Africa for solar lamps. And where businesses were not willing to move in and just didn't see it as viable, just to your earlier point, but they proved that it could be done. And then they sort of stepped back and let all these entrepreneurs who now had confidence that it could be done, come in and build the market. So that's exciting.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah. And I think if I was extremely wealthy, I think that that's what I would want to be doing with my money, is like be part of genuinely like making a huge impact, right?
And absolutely. You know? But I have to say, I don't think that's the majority yet. A lot of people are still very risk averse. I mean, I think it's changing, and I'm happy to see that it's changing, but I think it's changing slowly. I think risk is still a really big part of that conversation, and it needs to be continually addressed through the work that you're doing, through work we're doing, and that narrative. Like, constantly we need to be like shifting the lens, rebalancing the power, bringing those stories into the mainstream. And many organizations have shown successfully the power of narrative to shift perspective of risk. You know, one of the ways of doing it is also by framing what you're doing is as part of a bigger global challenge, right? For instance, those working on energy access can tell the story of climate resilience, and those working in food and agriculture spaces, you know, you're lifting up economies, and organizations then can be seen as investable. And they can also expand who sees them as investable. You know, going back to Water Equity's case, storytelling around women's agency helped unlock entirely new investor categories, from gender lens funds to ESG-driven institutional investors. It's reframing it as an opportunity versus a charity story. And I think that's really important.
Yeah, definitely. And I think there's always a bigger story there. And I think helping unlock that is where you can unlock so much more potential. So, for example, like sometimes we might think I'm doing this in this place and you're going, okay.
Yeah.
But what are the outcomes of that you're not maybe aware of, or as you say, that feed into an actual much bigger change?
That's right.
And then when you kind of see that, you're like, wow, what we're actually, we might feel like we're doing something that feels relatively small, but actually it is part of something way bigger. And then you really can unlock
absolutely
more inspiration, more capital, right?
Exactly. And it's building blocks, right? And nobody was born being Einstein. Well, maybe Einstein was, but, you know.
Only him.
But nobody's born. No, not only him, maybe. A bad example. But nobody's born knowing it all. Every day, you've got to learn. And even those people that feel they know it all, there's so much more to learn. And to the point that you were saying, and I also heard Audrey's part of the episode, actually. And I, you know, she was on Womanity's board as well. So it's a small world.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah. So, you know, what she was talking about, the collaboration, but everything is interconnected. And the fact that we don't see that enough, I think the social sector probably sees it more, because we realize that food cannot work without gender, without climate. Everything is interconnected. But I think on the donor side, we still have these silos, right? It's like, well, my capital is only working in this box, and that capital can do this. But that interconnectivity is not there on the capital side. And that's a huge, huge missed opportunity. And it's something that really direly needs to be addressed if we are to get capital moving at scale.
And I guess that seems to be what you're trying to do with Lebec, right? To pull together these different types of capital. Yeah.
Exactly.
The one thing I just wanted to ask you, I feel that another thing that hearing stories from the ground up can do, but especially if they're, I feel a component of that storytelling that builds trust as well, is talking about the challenges and the difficulties. Because I think sometimes it's human nature to a degree, especially if you're applying for funding or you're looking for funding, is maybe to kind of make it seem better than it is almost, you know? And I feel like there's a huge trust building component of telling the truth up front almost. Like, obviously you're framing it in the bigger opportunity, but you're kind of going, but I'm going to be real here. This is not easy. Or, you know, the goal is huge and there's a huge opportunity, but like there are challenges. I think that really, in the way we tell stories, that builds a lot of trust as well, I think. Although often there is a fear of maybe doing that.
Absolutely. I think there's a huge fear of doing that, because there's that power imbalance that we talked about, right? Because you often need that money and you want to dress yourself up or appear in the best way possible, right? But I think you're absolutely right. I think that honesty is very important. Maybe where in that conversation that comes in is strategic, right?
Yeah.
But I think failure generally across even the commercial, maybe the commercial sector is a bit more okay with it, but failure generally in our impact sector isn't seen as a way to learn. And I think that's a huge mistake as well. And I think it was Shell Foundation that first came out with their failure report, right? Or I don't know if it was a failure, but they started talking about failure and what works and what doesn't. Because like I said, this is, you know, even when you're building businesses, you fail. I think when I was with JP Morgan, we were working on supporting small business growth in South Africa. And it was like 80% of businesses fail within the first 2 years.
Yeah.
Right? And we're okay with that in the financial sector. But why are we not okay with trial and error and trying new things and failing and learning from that in the social impact sector? Mm. It's a missed opportunity, I believe. You know, through failure, different industries have been born in the finance sector, but it's not seen as the same thing in the social impact sector.
It's back to that kind of poor cousin thing that privilege of being allowed to fail almost, you know, because I remember I did a Prince 2 thing many years ago, project management. And one of the things they talked about was even on giant IT or infrastructure, you know, building infrastructure projects, the most valuable document of all from the entire project is the lessons learned document. Yet it very rarely gets read by the next, by the people doing the next project. You know, there's so much that could be learned from that document. But yet people go, I'm going to do it my way and, you know, whatever.
Exactly. Exactly. There's different motivations and especially in philanthropy, there's ego philanthropy still, which is really sad. And it's about, well, I know better. And it's so interesting because I think there are some organizations out there that want to prolong their existence. Whereas to me, it doesn't make sense because if you're trying to address an issue, like going out of business, it should be your aim because that means you've done it, right?
Exactly. And also you would want a great track record for like, imagine if I said, I've decided to tackle this thing and I've solved it. I'm going to close this up and I'm going to do it again somewhere else on a new issue.
Exactly. Exactly. Right? But the amount of times we see kind of like the opposite of just trying to stay and trying to exist, like how much more fun, like, and that's what grant funding does as well, to be honest. It creates that dependency and you're never going to find a way to be self-sustainable. And once you're self-sustainable, either you are embedded within the economy or you say, actually, the grant is no longer needed.
Yes.
Right. And that's where it should be headed. And I think it is happening. I don't want to be all kind of Debbie Downer. It is happening. But it is very slow. But that's okay because change takes time. And
it does,
Unfortunately, we don't have time with some of these global challenges, so we do need to move fast. But
how can storytelling shift how we think about who creates change and who funds it? It's interesting. I suppose that plays into the power thing. Like the funding, I guess, to a large degree, gets to decide who does it at scale. Obviously, there are, as you said earlier, like there are so many change makers we don't know about that are doing amazing stuff right now, wherever they are. But unfortunately, the ones that get the funding are the ones we're going to hear about and the ones that can scale and so on. So any thoughts on that, like that dynamic?
I think it's, again, kind of shifting that lens that I talked about. That's really important because storytelling can rebalance that power by changing that lens. And when people are telling their own stories, they're talking about innovation. They're not saying, help me. It's like, we've built these solutions. These are investable, right? Again, I think we talked about this a little bit. That shift moves us from aid to agency, right? Going from thinking that we can help them to actually, we're investing what they're already doing. And that's really important in the world of today where there isn't enough aid to go around, to be honest. There really isn't. And
especially
I think
now, right?
Aid does have a place. Exactly. Exactly. And aid does have a place, you know, especially humanitarian relief and things like that. It shouldn't be a constant. It shouldn't be a dependency, right? It should be, it's the first step. What is that next step? So I think if you're any foundation, if you're any capital allocator, and that's what we do at Lebec a lot, looking at, you know, any asset owner, looking at how can you be more catalytic with your capital? If that's philanthropy, if that's impact investing, if you're even investing from balance sheets, like how can you be more catalytic? What is that next step that you can take, right? Philanthropy is not there to exist forever. So I think that the reframing can attract new investors, right? And it can change how we perceive risk. It can take it away from like risk to an opportunity.
That's the big takeaway from me. I was just thinking that it's to flip it so that instead of it feeling like, oh, this is scary, how can we do it in the safest way possible, is this is exciting. This is a huge opportunity. Like, come on board. Let's do something amazing together. That kind of difference in how we frame it, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that's where the future needs to go as well. It's about storytelling as impact, not just storytelling about impact, right?
Yes.
And yes. That's a big difference.
Awesome. Just to finish up then, I always ask if there's a kind of a campaign that you loved that stood out to you. I also ask, you know, sometimes people prefer to share one they thought was awful, but whichever one you prefer.
Yeah. It's a good one, you know. I don't think I can pinpoint on any one campaign that did well or that didn't do well, but I think I would say some of the key ingredients, we've talked a little bit about it already, is being short and sweet, right?
Yeah.
Which a lot of organizations really struggle with. Mm-hmm. And like I said, at Lebec, we actually work directly with entrepreneurs who are building these solutions on their value propositions. It's like, how are you showing up in the world, right? Mm-hmm. What is your why? So I think anything that begins with a why and attracts that, I think you mentioned it once, that human connection and curiosity to learn more. Mm. I think those are the successful ingredients of a campaign. And I think even within the organization, when storytelling becomes like a strategic part of operating,
yes,
it can transform decision-making in an organization, right? It focuses one to immediately shift the lens. And I feel in philanthropy, it takes us to the place where we need to be, which is on the ground where change is happening. So I think just those ingredients I can talk about. But if you push me, I have to say this recent thing, like, it has nothing to do with our sector. I think I was booking a train ticket, Deutsche Bahn, right? The German rail. I don't know if you've seen this. It was pictures of places around the world. I don't know how, but like, it would be a bridge with a big, like a circular monument. And they found the same thing in Germany. So it was, I think the campaign was like, you don't need to fly, take more trains and it helps the climate because you can find what you're looking for around the world here. So literally they had pictures from around the world of like the lakes. They're so beautiful here, right? Like,
yeah,
literally some look like the Caribbean. And so they would have a picture of that and this is in Germany. And I was like, wow, this is really good. I haven't seen this in a while. And again, yeah, to the point, it's attracting curiosity because I'm like, oh, where in Germany is this? Where can I, you know, and it's to the point, it's like, you don't need to fly. Take the Deutsche Bahn. We've got the train. You can find the same thing here. So I think
that's great.
Conciseness is really, really important in the storytelling or campaigning side.
Yeah, I love that because it also, I often have thought over the years in aerospace, you know, you go to these events and you hear everyone talking and everything. And the thing that would always come back to me, the question to myself and to each of us, is we talk about all these things, but are we individually willing to slow down, to consume less? You know,
yeah,
a lot of times we talk it, but we don't want to have less. We don't want to, you know, ourselves. What I love about that campaign is that it's making it appealing, or dare I say, probably not sexy, but you know, like, interesting, you know, like in other words, attracting us to the better choice. So rather than it being like, oh, okay, maybe I should just stay in my home country this year.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, wow, that's exciting. I want to like do that. Like, so that's where it's very clever, isn't it? Where storytelling makes the better choice more appealing. It makes it easy.
Exactly. And shows you the possibility. Like we talked about opportunity, shows you, oh, well, I can do this, right? And I think that's also like the problem with climate change so far. People feel it's so far removed. Like, what can I do? How can I? Like, I'm just one person. What difference am I going to make? But you know, we've seen in the world of politics, every person can make a difference. And a good story will make you feel that you can impact change.
100%. Yeah, absolutely 100%. And I loved what you said at the end as well about embedding storytelling across the organization. I think it's almost one of the superpowers that people think it sits kind of in the marketing or, you know, in a certain part of the organization. But actually, one of the things I've been working on at the moment is, how can we help organizations build a storytelling operating system so that it's in all of the DNA of the whole organization? And how can you unlock those hidden stories that you aren't aware of at the moment, whether it is through your customers, your beneficiaries, your team, etc., to magnify the impact that you can have? So it's very uncertain times at the moment, but equally exciting times.
Yes.
I think there's a lot of things changing in the world right now. And We'll have to see how it all pans out. I feel like we all need to kind of rise to the challenge.
Absolutely. And I think that storytelling can be very catalytic. You know, it's not just describing impact, but it's enabling it, right? And so I think embedding that within the organization and realizing that it's not just an accessory, it should be really part of your infrastructure, is really important. And that's where we unlock something far more powerful than money, which is, I believe, it's belief and then also hope. You know, the world needs more hope.
Everybody
right now,
needs
really.
It, yeah.
And,
yeah.
Exactly. So.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
Listen, thank you so much. And it's been wonderful as well. I was probably already older than you when we met, but I was going to say back when we were young. But
yes.
It's been great to
yes.
see you doing so well and doing lots of great stuff. So thanks for coming on and chatting.
Thank
to
you
me.
So much. Thanks so much for having me. It's been really nice to talk about something which is hugely important, but I think the world doesn't see it as such. So thanks for bringing light to that.